My name's Jaleer. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi,
Billy was right. He said it's a quick lead-in. That's about the quickest lead-in I've ever seen. Billy called me. Thanks, Billy, for inviting me in. Thank you, everybody, for having me here. Billy called me about 3 months ago, and he says, would you speak? And I said, well, I'd be honored to. I'd be happy to. But there was one problem with that. I had 3 months to think about it. And you know what I was thinking about, right? I was thinking about me. See, that's the funny thing about Alcoholics Anonymous is that here we are, we get to learn how selfish and self-centered we are, right? And then we say, well, how do I, and then you ask the question, well, how do I recover? We say, well, you got to talk. What do I talk about? Talk about yourself. Selfish, self-centered. Talk about yourself. That's how you recover. So thank you again. I brought my big book with me, one of my big books. And the reason that I bring it is because the longer that I'm sober, the more that I find out how accurate and how true this book is. This book describes my alcoholism, and it describes the solution to my alcoholism. And it's in no uncertain terms. And although I'm one of those people that likes to refer to or quote the big book, when I'm at the podium, everything just kind of flies away. So I got to refer to the big book. By the way, my sobriety date is March 12, 1985. And I have a sponsor. And matter of fact, I have two sponsors. You know, some people will say, particularly to the new folks, don't get another sponsor. Don't get more than one sponsor because you don't want to try to go sponsor shopping because we alcoholics are good at that, doing that. But here's the reason why I have two sponsors. I've been sober a while and I've lost two sponsors already. One to cancer and one to old age. So I have two sponsors now. One is older than me, both in age and sobriety, and one is younger than me, both in age and sobriety. So I'm hedging all my bets. I'm not about to go and find another sponsor and break them in. Right? I've already got two sponsors broken in. So I got a sponsor, I got two sponsors. And it works well that way. What I wanted to start off is with page 55, which most of you are familiar with, and then I'll get into my story sometime, I hope. But it's really interesting what you all read here. I've never went to a meeting that starts off with page 29. That's what the purpose of telling your story is how did you find your connection with God? Because here's what it says on page 55. It says, for deep down in every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God. You know, when we were driving here, I asked my wife, I said, you know, I've been trying to look up the definition of fundamental. And it's the basis. It's the foundation. Okay. So deep down in every man, woman, and child is the foundation of God. So what that tells me is that God exists and we're built on that foundation. So there's no escaping. And it says, it may be obscured by calamity, by pomp, by worship of other things, but in some form it is there. So that's what I found out in this program. Is that when I came into AA, I started digging down. The purpose of these steps, the purpose of this program is to start digging down to find out where my foundation is. Now, I will tell you, and I hope that I don't run you out of here, you know, by starting out with the God idea, because guess what? The first time I came into AA, guess why I walked out? Because I looked at the steps, and I saw the word God, and I said, oh my goodness, Jesus freaks. And I was not into Jesus freaks. Now, my wife, my ex-wife, was raised a Baptist, and I respected my in-laws a lot, but I was not into Jesus freaks. Why? Because I was afraid of the idea of God. See, I had my own ideas. And it says, it was obscured by calamity, pomp, worship of other things, but in some form it is there. I was sober 4 months. I think it was 4 months. It's somewhere in early sobriety. And I call up my sponsor, one of my sponsors. I had a bunch of sponsors in my first year. I had a bunch of temporary sponsors, and I went through regular sponsors probably every couple of months. The next guy that I saw that I liked, you know, I tagged on to him until after my first year. I tagged on to the sponsor that ultimately died. So anyway, I called this one sponsor who was the EAP counselor, where they referred me at work. And I said, I don't know what you guys are making this big deal about sobriety. He says, what are you talking about? I said, you know, I mean, I get this thing, and I appreciate that sobriety is cool and everything, and everybody gets together and they don't drink. But you know what? It's boring. He goes, boring? He said, you don't know what peace is. I said, what are you talking about? He said, as an alcoholic, all you know is one crisis to another. That's how you lived your life. You don't know what peace is. Calamity. The fundamental idea of God is obscured by calamity. There's this part in Bill's story that I kind of understood it really recently. And here's what it says. It says, thus I was convinced that God is concerned with us humans when we want him enough. I didn't want God enough until I came into this program the second time. The first time I was at the door. It says, for a brief moment I had needed and wanted God. There had been a humble willingness to have him with me. And he came. So how does that happen? For me, you know, I think at the age of 8, I knew that there was something wrong. At the age of 8, I was being taught about God in school. And when I looked around and I saw how people behaved, and what they were really teaching you, it didn't match. So it just didn't gel for me. So that's how I grew up. I grew up on self-reliance. That ultimately, I think my father had a saying. He says, God is like, like a satchel of water. That's not the right word, but it's a canteen of water that you carry around in the desert. And when you're thirsty, you drink out of it. I'm still trying to figure out what the heck my father meant by that. But I know that that's not what it is. It's not what it is for me today. So I think God came to me a couple of times. And here's what happened. December 1984. That's the best of my recollection. December 1984. I was coming off of a couple of days drunk, and I was living with my mother at the time. I didn't have any money, although I worked full time. I was a manager at a government agency, and I was making decent money at the time, but I had no money because I spent it all on alcohol and for me drugs. And I'd been drunk for 2 or 3 days or whatever it was, and I just passed out in the basement. And I woke up in the middle of the night. There was no real appreciation of time for me. I woke up in the middle of the night. It was maybe about 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning. And this was pre-cable, all right? So this was antenna TV. So you didn't have 1,000 channels to roam. And they didn't go on, 24 hours a day. And I had I turned the TV on, and there wasn't, you know, much on the TV. But there was this public service announcement, and the public service announcement said, it was a blue screen, and it had a telephone number. And here's what the announcer's voice said. It said, if you think you have a drinking problem, you probably do have a drinking problem, call this number. Now, here's what happened to me. As soon as I heard that, a voice came to my head, and I still remember that voice. The voice wasn't my own. It wasn't like me talking to me, like I did for 3 months before I got here tonight, right? It wasn't me talking to me. It was somebody else talking to me. And the voice said, if you want to get sober, go back to AA. It took me 3 more months before I came back to AA. It took me a little bit more trouble. So how did I get there? Well, I think I had my first drink when I was about 16 years old. It was my childhood friend and I. You know, we would, he said, you know, let's buy some wine. We found somebody. This was up in New York. Drinking age was 18 at this time. So we got somebody to go in the liquor store and buy port wine. real high class stuff, right? Port wine. And it was just a pint. That's all it was. And we were drinking out of it. So my friend opens it up and takes a swig and he gives it to me. I said, no, I can't. I can't drink it like that. I can't take the taste of wine, you know. So I took the aluminum cap, right, poured a little in it, and just took a quick shot. And I kind of liked that. I thought that was really cool. Yeah, I said, I can take it in shots. Well, it wasn't too many shots before I was flying, you know. It worked really well for me. It felt great. And I remember, and I think this is what it was, but I remember it was, this was during the days of, you know, the what we call classic rock now. It wasn't classic rock back then. It was just rock. So we were listening to things like Steppenwolf, Born to Be Wild, and, you know, we were up in my friend's room, and he was playing, we were playing in front of an imaginary audience. He was playing the air guitar, and he had this little desk there, and I was playing the desk piano, the organ or something like that. We were just having a great time. So it kind of started clicking with me that I liked this stuff. I liked the feeling that it gave me. But strangely enough, this is mid-60s. Strangely enough, after several drunks, I made up my mind not to drink. And here's the reason why I made up my mind not to drink. I said to myself, and this is me talking to me, okay? If you want to know more about that, just read chapter 3. It'll tell you all about you talking to you. I said, you shouldn't drink because you don't want to grow up to be an alcoholic. Now, I don't know about you, but I don't know too many normal 16, 17-year-olds that say that to themselves. I don't want to drink because I don't want to grow up to be an alcoholic. So I didn't drink anymore. But I made another decision. I said, well, smoke pot instead. Why? It was because that was cool. I mean, that was like, that's what the generation was doing. I mean, anti-establishment, long hair, hippie, anti-war, and all that was really popular, and it was the cool thing to do. So that's what I did. I gave up alcohol to start doing drugs. And I said, you know, I'm only going to smoke marijuana or, you know, whatever we called it at the time. And that's what I'm going to do. And it was like a matter of weeks before I started experimenting with all kinds of other stuff, you know. And I was on my way. Now, at this point in my life, I had I'd made some other decisions. I made some great decisions in my life. I made some other decisions. I was tired of living at home with my parents. You know, I was becoming 18 years old, and my parents wouldn't let me out of the house. And I thought that once you became 18. In that generation, anyway, now you can't even get the kids out of the house. You know, they go to college and they want to come back. I said, you know, I'm 18. I want out of the house, and they wouldn't let me out of the house. So, what did I do? I joined the army. Now, here's a guy who had long hair, you know, preaching peace, anti-war, joins the army during the Vietnam War. So I joined the army. I want to be airborne. I go to jump school. I qualify jump school. I get thrown out of an airplane. I get kicked out of an airplane for the first time. And I love this experience. And then I make another decision. I volunteer to go to Vietnam near the end of the war. This is not exactly great thinking for a man who says he's against the war. But this is why I wanted to go to war. I wanted to go to war to die. I don't know if anybody have seen the movie Forrest Gump, Lieutenant Dan. Lieutenant Dan came from like a long family of military people, and he was supposed to die. You know, that was glory for him. That wasn't exactly my case, but I wanted to die. I wanted to die in glory. Why? Because I wanted to make a point to my parents. So I went to Vietnam. I wound up, I didn't go, I wasn't in war. I was a truck driver. I was a truck driver. And hardly drove out of the compound. We were in a compound most of the time. Go figure. I come back from Vietnam a heroin addict. And I kick heroin. I found a couple of people who give me some methadone and I kick heroin. And I get the feeling that I'm invincible. That's the whole point here. This is the alcoholic thinking. I know I'm talking about drugs, but this is alcoholic thinking. I'm invincible. There is nothing that can control me. So I found a group of guys, worked at a gas station, and they loved to smoke reefer, which is, you know, something that I did, but they loved to drink wine. So I started drinking wine. And many of you will know exactly what I'm talking about. It was Boone's Farm, Strawberry Hill. And every night we'd be at the gas station doing our thing and drinking Boone's Farm, Strawberry Hill. And one night appeared in my sights this beautiful young lady who was buying gas for her father's car. And I wind up marrying her. The thing is that, you know, I had to make my move. I made my move. We met. We fell in love over a period of time. And we wound up getting married. Now, all along, I'm thinking that if I got married, I'll fix my problem. My problem would be fixed. Never got fixed. See, my problem was that I could never stay with one woman. My problem was I just had to have more women. Remember, the fundamental idea of God is obscured by calamity and by desire of other things. So that was one of my problems. So after a while, she got the idea that I'm not material for stability in a marriage. So she divorced me. So once I got divorced, I figured what? I figured that my problem will be solved now. Because I'm not married. I could do what I want. And I don't have to drink as much. It's the biggest lie I ever told myself. So I got myself an apartment, a basement apartment. And the first night I got drunk, you know, beyond recognition. It was very common for me. Well, it wasn't too long before I got into trouble. And here's how it happened. As much as my wife loved me, it was part of the problem. Was she still loved me too much? And I would hang out in the bar, and I'd be drinking all night with the boys. And at about 2-3 o'clock in the morning, bars opened until 4 o'clock in the morning in New York. I'd go knocking on her door, and she would let me in. And this went on for a period of time until this wasn't working. Look, if we got divorced, we should be hanging around together. So one time she didn't let me in. She said, no, that's enough. Just go away. Now I got mad. Typical alcoholic. You know, I'm the kind of alcoholic, you know, these expectations of alcoholic, that in my neighborhood, if I see a UPS brown truck, I expect it to stop at my house and drop off a package or two. And I didn't order anything. I'm entitled, right? And if they don't give it to me, it's their fault. So when she denied me, I got angry and I and basically I kicked the screen door in. Now, the landlady didn't like that. I get a call the next morning from my ex-wife, and she said, the cops are looking for you, because the landlady filed a complaint. So I'm an upstanding guy in my mind. I'm an upstanding guy. So I voluntarily go to the police department. And she gave me the detective's name, so I look up the detective. I go to the front desk, is Detective so-and-so here? They said, yeah, sure, what's your name? I give him my name. They said, just a minute, we'll be right back. Guy comes down from upstairs, takes me upstairs. And after a while, we're having this nice conversation. And after this nice conversation, he said, did you do this? I said, yeah. So I figured, you know, if I admit to it, everything's cool. No problem, right? We'll take care of it. See you around. We won't do this again. No problem. So he said, put your hand out like this. And I didn't. He put the cuffs on. All of a sudden, it was click. I said, and I, at this point, I'm offended. You know, how could he arrest me? I mean, this is not right. So this was my first arrest. I wind up going to jail overnight. I get released the next morning. I call a lawyer. I don't know whether this firm is around anymore. It was called Jacoby and Myers, and they were billboard stuff, and you call the number and you get a lawyer by phone. So I got assigned a lawyer by phone. I told him my case, and he goes, no problem. What I want you to do is I want you to go see a counselor. See a counselor for a couple of months. We'll get a letter, give it to the judge, and the judge will let you off. And I said, good. That's what I did. So I go to a counselor. First night I'm at the counselor's office, she said, what are you doing Friday night? I'm thinking, well, I'm making time with this counselor. I haven't even met her yet. I said, I guess nothing much. She says, there's an AA meeting that I want you to go to. I'm thinking, AA, what is AA got to do with me? Because maybe it's something like the Automobile Club of America or something. You know, I really had no idea. I might have had some idea in the back of my mind, but I didn't know what AA was. And that's when I walked into AA. And I walked into AA. I don't know what I was expecting, but I wasn't expecting the word God. And when I saw that word God, and they said to me, they said, buy this little book. It was a 24-hour book. He said, read it every day. And every day it was just another problem. I said, oh, the word God in here, the word God in here. This is really bad. You know. 2 months later, I think, I was gone. I got the counselor convinced that I was going to AA meeting. She wrote the letter, gave it to the lawyer, and I was done. So I was free again. I thought that I had solved my problem because I wasn't drinking. I was not drinking. I was going to meetings once a week, leaving the meeting, getting in my car, lighting up some reefer, patting myself on the back of my back, thinking that I've got it made. So here I am, a single guy. I go to this disco. You call them clubs nowadays. Disco back then. And I meet this young lady. And the young lady says to me, after a while talking with her, we're just sitting there talking, she says, why don't you buy me a drink? And I said, sure, what would you like? She said, Chivas and water. So I buy her Chivas and water, and I bring it to her. And everything looked so good, so innocent, so fine. You know, the music is going. I said, what is this Chivas? She says, oh, this is top shelf scotch. Now, this is classic for me, and this is exactly what the third chapter talks about. Something went off in my head. What went off in my head was a thought, and the thought was this. It said, Ilir, if you want to drink and not be an alcoholic, learn to drink scotch. Now, that is something. Alcoholic thinking or what? Now, that is something that I didn't think of myself. I just remembered it because it was something that my best friend's father told us kids. He was like the dad of the neighborhood where everybody, you know, everybody loved and hung out with. And he would tell us stories about about the Depression, everything that they did. And we all loved him and hung on every word and believed everything he said. And that happened like 17 years prior to this point. But I remembered it. The alcoholic mind takes information, packages it, hides it, tucks it away until it's needed. And that's when it came out. And I started drinking scotch. Life took a turn for the worse. And I was drinking scotch and I was doing cocaine. And I got arrested for a DWI. Went to jail for that. Didn't stay long. It was another overnight thing. But it seems that everything was getting worse. I had no money to speak of. I had no relationships to speak of. Every woman that I met got to figure me out. And these were slow women, let me tell you. It took them 2 months to figure me out. 2 months, they were like, you know, just stay away from me because you're only interested in two things. And I did not know how to have a relationship with another human being. But the thing about, in my story, when it came to alcohol and cocaine, it did crazy things to me. Now, in the book, it says, and if I can find it in a second, I'll refer to it. It says about the real alcoholic. What it says about the real alcoholic is that he is like a Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. It says he does absurd. Those are the things that we... The things that we hear in stories that we laugh about. We just do crazy things. Incredible and tragic things. The incredible things are things that we would ordinarily not do. Those things that we have natural human inhibitions that we break through. We go against our inhibitions. Those are the things that we are taught. Those are the things that are morals. We break through those morals as alcoholics. And tragic things, which means we create danger and we can kill people. It happens. Here's the incredible thing that happened to me. I was on alcohol and cocaine and I was on it for about 2-3 days and I had lost all my sensibilities. I met a young woman at a bar, took her to my house and attacked her with bad intent. Nothing happened, thank God, because I came to my senses. But I attacked her with bad intent, and I was arrested. And I was charged with a felony. Now, here I am. I'm charged with a felony. I'm still working. I'm still trying to things happen. I'm still trying to make things work because I think I can make them work. And that December day happened. But how bad it got before I got that December day, I found myself sitting at the edge of the bed with a 30-06 in my mouth. It was a bolt action, and it had a bullet about this long in it. And I'm ready to push the trigger. And if you ever had a stock on the ground with a muzzle in your mouth, you know that that's what you'd have to do, is push the trigger. You're not pulling the trigger. And I was ready to push the trigger, but I didn't have the guts to do that. So when it says in the book, you know, you get to the point where you don't want to live and you don't want to die. I know exactly what that felt. At that point, I'm facing 8 to 15. Life is crumbling around me. I don't want to live and I don't want to die. And I don't know what the heck I wanted to do. And the thought came. When we are ready. And when we sincerely want God, He comes. He gave me that thought. So I go back to AA finally, and it was 3 years to the day that I went back to the AA meeting. And you know how I know that is because I kept that 24-hour day book, and I had this place finder, and I had it on March 15th. And that's when I walked back into AA. My last drink was on March 12th. And I walked back into AA 3 years later on March 15th. There's something remarkable about March 15th and giving up drinking. 2 days before St. Patrick's Day? Who gives up drinking before Patrick's Day, 2 days before St. Patrick's Day? Well, yeah, that's how it happened to me. And I started doing what people told me to do. Why? I was out of options. I was out of options. It was death. You know, it's in chapter 2 where it talks is when you're at that point in the road where it's drink until you die or accept spiritual help. You know, it was one of those things that you hear a lot of people say, well, I had to think about it. Well, there wasn't much thought on my part. You know, because I didn't have the guts to kill myself. So I started going to meetings. And I was starting to get matriculated in AA. This is kind of a crazy word, but I was starting to get to know people. People became familiar with me. I started becoming familiar with people. But still, I had this one thing, and what it was is that I missed my friends. Now, the only friends that I had were people in the bar. Those are the only friends that I had. No other friends. Why? Because I had no use for any other friend. I did not hang out with anybody that didn't drink like I did. There was no use for them. You know, I don't get the idea. I never got the idea that there are people who just don't drink or don't like to drink, because I never hung out with them. You know, in a doctor's opinion, it says men and women essentially like the effect produced by alcohol. You know what my reaction to that is? No kidding. Really. That's why people do it. I never realized that there are people who do not like the effect produced by alcohol. You know, yesterday, my wife and I had some neighbors over. They came over, and I went out and bought beer for them, right? I bought a 12-pack of beer, put it in the ice, because, you know, you treat your neighbors like regular people. There were 4 adults, 2 adult children, and 4 of them drank beer. 4 of them drank beer. At the end of the night, when everybody left, I fished 6 bottles of beer out of that tub. Now, do the math. 4 people drank 6 bottles of beer. I have no use for those kind of people. What, you know, you want to talk about alcohol abuse? You've heard this. That's alcohol abuse. It's there to be drank, for crying out loud. Well, those are the kind of people that I hung around with. So after the meeting, what I would do is I'd go to my, what I called my home bar, and I'd go hang out with those friends. But I went to meetings and I kept hearing this word, honesty, honesty, honesty. You got to be honest. You got to tell your sponsor everything. You got to be honest with your sponsor. It was eating at me. I wasn't drinking, all right? But it was eating at me. Did you ever see the movie Flight? The first time the main character goes to a meeting and he's taking his girlfriend to the meeting, he turns around and he walks out. That guy who was speaking, Two Beer Barry, that guy who was speaking, what was he saying? You heard it in the background. He was talking about, I finally got honest with myself. And at the end of the movie, that's what happens, is he finally gets honest. So that's what happened with me. I kept hearing this, you got to be honest, you got to be honest. So I called up my sponsor, and I tried to make it, as casual as possible. And he said to me, he said, oh, so what did you do last night, Alir? Did you go to a meeting? I said, oh, yeah, I went to a meeting. I stayed sober. I'm not drinking. Good. He says, so what did you do after that? Oh, I went to hang out with some of my friends. He says, what friends are those? That's the kind of sponsor that I had. Would always ask the question. Because he knows that when I'm saying something and I'm not really talking, that there's more information there that I'm not willing to let out. I said, oh, I went to the Heritage. That was the name of the bar. I went to the... He said, the Heritage, what's that? I said, that's the bar that I drank at. That's where my friends hang out. So I went there to hang out with my friends and play a little pool. and play a little foosball. And hey, by the way, you know that game foosball? You know that table hockey? I said, I'm more coordinated now that I'm sober and I'm playing it better. He goes, oh, you're playing fool's ball. Really? He said, about these friends that you have at the bar. He said, do you realize that the people in AA are the same kind of people you hung out with in the bar, except that they're not drinking? It was like a revelation. I said, really? I didn't know that. He said, why don't you try hanging out with those newfound friends and see what happens? And I took that suggestion. And when I took that suggestion, that is when I joined the fellowship. The Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, the component that is a fellowship, that's when I joined it. And everything changed. Everything changed. And when I started getting honest with my sponsors and I started getting honest with people, things really changed. I sat down with a sponsor that I had. I'll never forget him, Vinny B. He was like the second in the chain of sponsors. And I sat down. We were at a meeting and we were sitting there. And I decided to tell him what the heck was going on with me in my life. And I said, Vinny, you know, I got a court date that's coming up. I'm facing 8 to 15. I said, I'm in debt about $30,000. I don't know what to do with it. I said, I don't have a relationship to speak of. All I do is, you know, just go to work. I said, my life is miserable. I'm sober now, right? And I'm talking about the things that I'm afraid of because I never talked about what I was afraid of before. I'm an Albanian. That's my culture. Albanian, I grew up, men don't talk about their fears. Men conquer their fears. Men conquer everything around them. And if you don't do that, you're less than a man. So I was taught not to talk about them. And he said to me, he said, first of all, he said, the justice system is meant to be fair. So you'll have to go through what you have to go through. And then he said, he asked me a question. He said, do you pray? And I went, uh-oh. I said, I don't know who to pray to. And that was the key. That was the key because what I realize now, and for a while now that I didn't know back then, was that though I believed in God, remember I told you when I was 8 years old, I knew that there was something wrong. I knew that there was a God. You know, it's there. Everybody's taught that there's a God. That was the key. The key was, though I believed that there was a God, I did not believe that God could do for me what I could not do for myself. Remember the 9-step promises? The very last promise says, we came to see how God does for us what we can't do for ourselves. And, you know, what he said to me wasn't very different than what Ebby Thatcher told Bill. When he said, Bill, why don't you choose your own understanding of God? It was the same thing. And he said, don't worry about it, just pray. And I had to just trust that. I just had to trust that. And I started to pray. I started to pray on my knees at night. I would say the Serenity Prayer and I would say whatever else that came to mind. And I started having these revelations. I started feeling good about myself. I have a friend of mine who uses the saying, and it's a great saying. He says, don't do things that make you feel good. Do things that make you feel good about yourself. When I was drinking, and when I was, you know, fooling around, when I was doing all these crazy things, I was trying to make myself feel good. I wanted to feel good, which turned against me. I never knew to do things to make me feel good about myself. You heard the expression, if you want self-esteem, do esteemable things. So that's when the road started working. So I have this lawyer. I pay him $5,000 to get me off the hook, and he doesn't get me off the hook. Why? Because that's not what God wanted. but I get a very light sentence. Of course, it wasn't a felony. It was a misdemeanor. Misdemeanor assault. And I go to jail. And I go to jail for 60 days. And I get out in 40 days with good time. And then they send me off. I was in Nassau County. After a couple of weeks, they sent me off to Erie County Jail, which is up in Buffalo, New York. And that's the old type jail with the old type tiers, you know, where everybody goes into a cell and they all close at the same time and then make all this crazy noise. The kind that you see in the old movies, not the new movies. I don't know what they show anymore. And I was going to meetings at the jail. I was transferred from one jail to another during a holiday, and they took all my AA material and they gave me the New Testament. They said, read. They didn't say read. They said hear. It was up to me to read. So I started reading that, and I started underlining everything that sounded like AA. I still have that book. You know how much stuff I underlined that sounded exactly like AA? And I'm no more thinking, oh my God, it's Jesus Freaks. Now I'm thinking, oh my God. Oh my God. This stuff is the same thing. Just packaged a little differently. It's packaged so that I can understand it. So I'm going to these once a week meetings in jail, and somebody gives me a step book. I'm starting to read the 12th and 12th. And one night, it was time to go into the cell. It was, I don't know what time they closed that, 9 o'clock or 10 o'clock at night. And everybody walks in front of their cells. They open up the cells, and you walk in, and all the gates clang, close behind you. And when they close, I mean, they close. You hear them. It's a clang. Matter of fact, you can feel the floors shake, reverberate. And I walk into that cell. I hardly turned around yet. I'm just walking in there. I hear this closing behind me of these iron doors behind me. And I have a feeling like I've never had before. It was a feeling of freedom. I was in a 5x7 jail cell with a metal toilet. And what they give you as a mirror is nothing but a sheet metal and a 2-inch mattress on a steel rack. And I never felt so free in my life. It was a feeling of peace and freedom like I had never known. My sponsor, that guy I told you about, Vinny, he would take calls from the jail for me, and I would call him collect. The next day, I couldn't wait until I called him to tell him about this experience. And I remember what he said to me. He said, just slow down. Because I was talking a mile a minute. A day later, I'm still excited about this experience. And he said, slow down, slow down. Well, I got out of jail and I went to meetings like I never did before. You know, when I started going to meetings, it was like, you know what? I'll go to meetings during the week, but the weekends are for me. Now I started going to meetings during the weekend. And now I started going to step meetings. I started doing all those things that my friends who were sober for some time started doing. Things began to change in my life. One of the things that began to change was about 10 months into recovery. Now my third sponsor, a guy by the name of John up in Elmont, said, you know, Aaliyah, you've been really good. You've been working your program. You've been doing everything right. He says, I'm going to introduce you to a young lady I know. I said, she wasn't young. She was older than me. So we went to this dance, this AA dance, and he introduces me to her. And we hit it off. She was attractive. I was attractive enough to her. And we started getting to know each other. And then something happened to me. As we were starting to get closer together, I felt pain. The pain that I felt was, it was guilt. The guilt was this. Said, how can I really get into a relationship when I never came through with the promises I made in my marriage, in my first relationship? I had to abandon that relationship, and with the help, I was seeing a therapist, and I was with the help of a sponsor, I contacted my ex-wife. I contacted my ex-wife, and I started a relationship with her, and she told me that she was seeing somebody, and that killed me. That hurt me. Remember before I told you, we selfish, self-centered alcoholics, when I see that UPS truck, I expect a package. I didn't order anything. She told me that she had a boyfriend. And she wasn't really interested in me. That was painful. I cried. I remember running up to my sponsor's best friend and hugging him. He didn't know what the heck was happening. And I just cried on his shoulder. And I remember what my sponsor said to me. He says, you know, you're a typical alcoholic, typical male. He said, you think that when a woman falls in love with you, she can never fall in love with anybody else. That you're it. And that was the lie that I lived in. So I had to accept that fact, and we developed a relationship and we became friends. After a period of time, I had to go see her parents. I had to make my amends. I go see her parents, and our relationship is developing now. We want to get back together. Her parents were very nice to me. They were very cordial. They sat there in their living room, and I told them what was going on in my life. And at the end of it, they said, Ilir, we're very happy for you that you're doing these things for yourself. He says, but if you want our daughter back, and you want back in our lives, we are not interested. And I had to walk away from that satisfied. That was okay. That's them. We wound up getting married. They came to the wedding perfunctorily. They had to. It was their daughter. Here's what happened 5 years later. 5 years later, after we reestablished our relationship, I was putting a music program together for their 50th anniversary of their wedding. And my mother-in-law said this to me. She said, Ilir, sit down. We have something to tell you. And I said, what? She said, you know, when you came back into our lives, we did not trust you. We had no foundation to trust you. She says, but what we want to tell you is that we were wrong. You know, I don't think I could ever tell that story without these feelings that happened to me in my throat and my eyes. I loved my parents-in-law until I died. Yeah. When my mother-in-law died, I was at the hospital and I was holding her hand. I had my hand on her face. I don't think I've ever felt a greater moment than that moment. Janice, who's with me tonight, is my wife. We're going to be celebrating 27 years as a result of this program. Lots of great things happened to me. I've, you know, had a good career and everything. There's just so much that I learned about the steps. There's so much that I learned about helping other people. There was so much I learned about doing esteemable things and feeling good about myself instead of trying to feel good. It doesn't make me perfect. I'm about as imperfect as I can be. All you have to do is just ask my wife what I'm really like and how silly and stupid I can be. And she will tell you. I mean, I just do some dumb thing. Sometimes I'm just a kid. I'm just a little kid, you know. And I just want to be mothered, you know. But she does that for me. What my mother-in-law, what my wife has taught me was what God's true love is. It's everything that is good in life stems from love. because they love me unconditionally. Something that I don't know how to do. Something that I have to keep practicing. But this unconditional love, I learned in AA, and here's how it works in AA. It's very simple, and we do it all the time. A guy walks into Alcoholics Anonymous, and we say, welcome. Same guy goes out, gets drunk, and he comes back, and we say, you're welcome. Guy goes out, gets drunk again, comes back, we say, welcome. Any other place, they kick him out. What do we say? I got drunk last night. Keep coming back. Don't ever give up. Keep coming back, because we never know when the miracle is going to happen. We never know when God talks to them. We never know when God comes. I told you that I was a Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. That's what I was. I've done absurd, incredible, tragic things. Many of us have done absurd, incredible, tragic things. Yet we've been given a gift. Through the second step and the ensuing steps, we've been given a different power. We're powerless over alcohol. So in order for us to live, to survive, we've been given a spiritual power, a different power. Here's what that power is. It says, page 124, and by the way, this is how how I found this reference? I know I got about 3 minutes and I'm going to stop. I found this reference. There was this Bill Wilson movie that came out about 3 years ago. It was like that documentary. If you look at that poster, it'll say page 124 Productions on the bottom. Small print. Page 124 Productions. So I looked up, so I read page 124, and I'm trying to figure out what are these people, getting from page 124. Here's what I believe and what I think they're referring to in page 124. It says, cling to the thought that in God's hands, the dark past is the greatest possession you have. The key to life and happiness for others. With it, you can avert death and misery for them. In the 12th and 12th, and says, Bill said, we who have so handsomely won in a walk became all-time losers. And in the fourth step, he talks about, he says, our character defects created our alcoholism, which created our failure. I am a miserable failure as an active alcoholic, yet I was given a gift. We will neither regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it. That gift is my past. The power that I have that's lent to me is my past. The tragic, the incredible, the absurd things that I've done is that power that's been given to me freely. It wasn't given to anybody else. It was given to us alcoholics. And today, somewhere, somebody's going to walk into Alcoholics Anonymous. Just as much as we did. They're not going to want to live, and they're not going to want to die. They're going to want to die, and they're not going to have the guts to kill themselves. Some do, and they never make it here. And they come here for help. And it's our past that saves their lives. It's Alcoholics Anonymous. Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank you.
Thank you.